In the following presentation, Toward an Anti-Authoritarian Commitment to International Solidarity, Andrea Schmidt talks about her experiences in occupied Iraq. This was recorded on September 25th, 2004, at the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference in Plainfield, Vermont.
So my name's Andrea, and I have lived and organized in Montreal for the past number of years. And I spent 3 months in occupied Iraq from February to May of this year as a delegate of the Montreal-based collective that is called the Iraq Solidarity Project, a project that has had as its mandate to make direct links between movements and collectives, activists working against occupation and against war in Montreal and in Quebec more broadly with people, movements, organizations in Iraq, and in so doing to help monitor abuses by occupation forces in Iraq and the takeover of the Iraqi economy by foreign companies and to build links of solidarity in that process. And also to link very much the fact that what is going on in Iraq is an occupation. It's the instantiation of a neocolonial regime and economy, and to make the links between that and the fact that we live in a colonized territory also, and must be in many ways that this presentation will not even touch, be part of decolonization movements there. In this presentation, I'm going to ultimately focus on not only why I think it's imperative that we as anti-authoritarians or as anarchists engage in international solidarity work and talk about the values that I think then we can draw on to inform that work and to make it good work and not counterproductive or destructive work, but also talk about different models of international solidarity. And there I'll really be drawing on my limited experience in Iraq, where I am highly critical of what is going on there under the name of international solidarity, and talk then about a range of ways of thinking about models of international solidarity without ever resolving the question of which one we need to buy into or to use, because I think some of those are going to be, some of those questions around which one to buy into are place and movement specific. And also because I genuinely don't know, and I'm still really wrestling with those questions. This whole presentation, I want to add, is very much a product of reflection I've done since returning from Iraq. But in that, although I'm the only person speaking on this, I feel like I've been in dialogue and I'm really indebted to conversations I've had with a bunch of committed people who live in Montreal and in Toronto. Mary, who's here. Justin, Samira, Sarita, Michael, a whole range of other people, people in the IAS also, and Mustafa, who I was an activist who was supposed to come down for this weekend, and he's an Arab guy who lives in Toronto, has a lot of experience with Palestine solidarity work. He was worried about being able to cross the border, and I think that's a good place of departure for us in terms of broaching these anti-occupation movements, particularly when we're dealing with the Middle East and making links with a sort of lockdown on Fortress North America, where increasingly Arab and Muslim populations are under incredibly direct attack. But before I go into, so I just wanted to sort of name all the other people who are really part of this presentation, because so often we kind of pretend that we think all these things ourselves, but really I've just pulled a lot of really smart people. So that's what you're getting today, is the results of that poll. Before I go into any of that, though, and I feel like it's important to talk for just a few minutes about the realities of occupation in Iraq as I was able to see them, partly because it's an occupation that is growing increasingly brutal and deadly every day. And partly because there's really not been a lot of discussion in about Iraq, you know, so far over the weekend. And to me, it's just a really vital thing for us to deal with. So I'm going to start with that. I was in Baghdad for 3 months between February and the beginning of May. And the face of the illegal US-UK occupation of Iraq really changed substantially in that time. When I arrived, Baghdad was a place, and I mostly stayed in Baghdad, so I think my perceptions are colored by being in an urban center also, and that's important to talk about. The occupation really had a day-to-day face of violence that is a violence of grinding poverty, of 60% unemployment, where there's not electricity in most areas of the city for most of the day. You get electricity for 3 hours, and then it would go out. You get it for 3 hours. If you were living in a wealthier part of the city, or if you were living in one of the foreigners' hotels, you had access to generators that would pick up when the electricity went down. But for most people, most of Iraq, you didn't have access to those generators most of the time. So there's very little electricity. Families were being displaced and finding themselves without housing, in part because the housing situation in many poor areas of Iraq was so bad before the invasion. And that meant that people were moving their families to find a little bit more space in old bombed-out buildings, in old Secret Service Mukhabarat buildings, in old regime buildings. So there are camps of squatters in these sort of abandoned places all over the city. And on one level, that talks about the extreme poverty and that existed. And on the other hand, it's sort of, you can look at it as a form of resistance, that people were very much taking some form of direct action to meet their needs, and often in a very, you know, fuck you both to the old regime, whose place we're now squatting, these buildings that terrorized people under Saddam's regime, and fuck you to the occupation that promised us freedom and prosperity, and we're taking back what we need in our way. During this whole period, there was a promise of reconstruction. We all know the $18.4 billion that was allotted to reconstruction in Iraq, supposed to be contracted out for companies like Halliburton and Bechtel. This money, the very small portion of it that was actually spent, was redistributed through foreign firms and subcontracted through other foreign firms and subcontracted again, sometimes to Iraqis and sometimes to other foreign firms, at a time again where there was tremendous unemployment. While factories were being closed, or in an ultimate attempt at denationalizing all the industry in Iraq, it was being carried out by the Coalition Provision Authority, that has now been, of course, replaced since June 30th, ostensibly by John Negroponte and the highly armed American embassy in Iraq, and by the interim government there that was instated and not elected. So that was the end of June. At the same time, you know, that there's this massive grinding poverty in which people are trying to find jobs, and the most lucrative jobs are unfortunately then translating, interpreting, policing, and being part of the new Iraqi military under the command and in collaboration with the occupying forces. People are also experiencing the day-to-day violence of house raids, American troops coming in to detain people, often not knowing who they were coming into your house to detain, but knowing that they wanted to detain somebody, and that would take place, and often at night, with full military equipment, women and children dragged out of their beds, unveiled, Qurans kicked onto the ground, and family members forced to watch other family members be beaten and then detained, and often people were taken as hostages. Family members, older sisters, other members of the family would be taken hostage by the American military in order to ensure that other people, the people they were seeking to detain, would turn themselves in order to have their sisters go free. And this was also a period in which I arrived before the Abu Ghraib photos of sexual humiliation and torture were widely available in the media, but it was a period in which people very much knew that there were tremendous abuses in detention. There's over 10,000 people in detention in various detention centers around the country when I arrived. And people knew that people were being tortured. And so when the photos came out, the reaction there from a number of people, not monolithically, of course, because there's never a monolithic reaction, but many people, you know, his reaction was, well, why is the U.S. media showing these pictures to humiliate us now? We've known this is going on. Mm-hmm. So what is the strategy? Is this further humiliation, or is this really telling our story? By the time I left, the situation had changed, and the occupation had a much more openly military face, and there was open warfare in a number of places. There had been aerial bombings of Fallujah, and you know, the use of Marines and snipers sniping at ambulances as people tried to flee the city, and as you know, the armed resistance was being waged in Fallujah. 700 people were killed in Fallujah during that time, and that was like a vast example of the sort of collective punishment that has continued in the past few months of occupation since I've left. There was also Muqtada al-Sadr's uprising in the Shia, mostly Shia and incredibly poor slum of Thawr or Sadr city. In Baghdad, and I was sort of in that area for the first couple of days of both of that uprising as it began and of the U.S. incursions into it, and helicopters were coming over and shooting missiles into people's kitchens. The tanks were rolling in and shooting sort of at random, and so if you were a child behind a door, you were getting killed. And then the asymmetry, of course, between the weaponry used by the resistance in that area and the tanks, the U.S. Army, who have, you know, whatever, armored personnel carriers and tanks and, you know, night vision goggles and heat detectors, that asymmetry was incredible and resulted, I think, in 100 people being killed in that first few days. But I was still there, and then by July, over 1,000 people had been killed in Sadr City. And now the aerial bombardment continues right now as we speak, and that's just become a day-to-day reality in that area, as it has in Fallujah and in other places around the country. And for all this, and for all that, it was hard for me to grapple with you know, seeing resistance. There were so many forms of resistance going on, whether that was the mutual aid that was being exercised through the mosques, largely in places like Sadr City and throughout the country, in fact, redistributing food, directing traffic, and also organizing militias to defend neighborhoods against the army incursions. There are demonstrations of many sorts during that time, and of course there was the armed resistance, which takes many different forms and has many different political tendencies in Iraq, and that's one of the things that you then need to grapple with, because the tendencies of the armed resistance obviously mirror political tendencies in Iraq, and those are the things, the political questions you grapple with in doing certain forms of solidarity work in the country. And all this organizing, all this resistance was going on in spite of the fact that there's a tremendous fear and tremendously justified paranoia in this country that has been subsumed under a dictatorship that was very deadly, very brutal, that, you know, basically outlawed any form of speaking against the government, that very much isolated people who weren't highly trusted by the regime from the outside world and made it nearly impossible for there to be any contact between people that they didn't send to greet the foreigners who were part of, say, the anti-sanctions movement, who were sent into the country before the war. And so a very isolated society in many ways, and a society that, you know, if in Palestine at the last panel, people, John Petrovato was talking about how, you know, people in the occupied territories will talk about how wonderful individual Americans are because those are the people they've met. In Iraq, the people, the foreigners, for the most part, that Iraqis have met are CIA and Mossad, and that's who's been there. And so that also then colors the context in which we need to operate if we're doing solidarity work. So that gives you a slight sense of the occupation. My role in going was, I thought, to do two things, and I'll talk about them both as models of solidarity that were very problematic. The first was that I was to work with a center called the Occupation Watch Center in Baghdad that had been set up by several international NGOs, including Global Exchange and Code Pink, who were the sort of American participation in that. And I call this whole model of solidarity a sort of soft imperialist model of solidarity, where what happened was, the way it was set up, was that the American organizations went to Iraq in February of 2003, right before the invasion, knowing that it was going to be a hot spot as the invasion started. They had very little prior involvement or knowledge of the country. They were given contacts, as all foreigners entering the country were given contacts by the Ba'athist regime, who, you know, were trusted people. And then based on those contacts, they proceeded in April to begin setting up the Occupation Watch Center, where internationals were supposed to come and write human rights reports and monitor various aspects of the occupation. There was very limited dialogue with people of various tendencies, political tendencies, in Iraq. They basically relied on the two people, or the three people they knew. That's who they hired to set up the center. And when those issues were raised as political issues, when it became apparent that the center was not able to create sort of basic people-to-people or movement-to-movement links in Iraq, and that didn't ever seem to be a problem. The point of the center, those links weren't possible because many people in Baghdad, it seemed, didn't trust the center because they thought it was another instantiation of the old regime trying to retake power, because that's who they felt. Whether it's true or not, I will never know. But the fact was that enough political work hadn't been done, and it had been set up with such haste and with so much the needs of a North American and European movement in mind, a movement that simply wanted to be able to say, we are in Baghdad, and this is why the war should end, and this is why the occupation should end, and this is what our contacts in Baghdad are saying, that it really made it impossible in some ways to create genuine and accountable relationships to anybody in the area. And so when that also made the project very vulnerable when, say, the kidnappings of foreigners began in April, there's very few contacts that could advise you whether you should stay, whether you should leave, whether you should continue trying to do the work, whether the entire project should just end. Made it very, very vulnerable. The other thing I was trying to do, I think, was to do sort of standard independent reporting. And there was sort of a whole crew in Baghdad of independent reporters. People called themselves independent reporters, meaning, I think, that they weren't affiliated with a major corporate international media chain. This is sort of the model of solidarity, as I saw it instantiated in Iraq, that is sort of like the reifying colonial patterns of information relay model of solidarity work. Because basically what was happening was that all these leftists were going to Baghdad, writing up reports about what was going on, which is useful, right? Because we hope that those reports then awaken the conscience of people back home, so that, you know, those will, you know, make our movements here that are opposing the war, opposing the occupation in the belly of the beast, we hope that they will vitalize and revitalize those movements and tell stories that the international media just isn't picking up, right? We hope that we can connect with the reality that the international media isn't interested in. But basically what people were doing were writing those reports and sending them out, which is that's it, right? Which is exactly the process of sort of a colonialist extraction of information, of knowledge, of resources, and you send it back to the metropolis, and that's it. There's no feedback. There's no accountability to the people you've written reports about. There's no long-term relationship involved in constructing those reports and trying to frame the questions you're addressing in them with the people you're interviewing, never mind sort of them being accountable to movements. And this isn't to say that we function exactly like the international media functions in Iraq. We mostly didn't live behind the barbed wire and the armed guards and the blast walls, the hotels guarded by U.S. soldiers. Most people sort of veered away, or most of the sort of independent reporters tried to stay away from feeling entirely at home in the hotel complexes with pools and luxury and all that, the decadence and offensiveness of expat society in what essentially ends up being a colonial outpost for us. Unlike the CNN or whatever, we didn't travel with armed guards or with mercenaries most of the time, and tried not to travel in highly ostentatious SUVs. But essentially, the pattern was exactly the same, as I've said. And beyond that, people were relying on people who were going tended to be white, North American or European, and didn't speak Arabic for the most part, like myself. So we're relying on the same translators and fixers. And translation is, of course, an incredibly politicized endeavor in any place, right? Same translators and fixers that the international media were relying on ended up having the same tendency to chase bombs and explosions, which may or may not be an edifying thing to do in a place like Iraq. And most problematic, I think, the same tendency to go in with prefabricated conclusions about what was wrong with the situation and to try to extract the quotations from people they spoke to in order to send home, in order to sort of confirm what we already knew, right? Now, we might think that we have a better ideology around being anti-occupation than say CNN does. But ultimately, the actual activity is no different, right? The actual process is no different. And it ended up, or it resulted in the fact that we all used, the independent reporters, the international reporters, all asked the same question of people in Iraq, which basically always amounted to, was it worse before the war or after? Was it worse under Saddam, or is it worse under the Americans? Which is both an impossible question for people to answer and a fairly despicable one for us to ask. And I don't think it's the question that we would be asking if we weren't so rootless there, if we weren't functioning without any genuine relationship or ongoing and accountable relationship to people. Because I think insofar as independent reporting is useful in our own movements, here in North America, it's because when we send out reports, we're accountable to people. People read them. People in those movements criticize us for them. There's an ongoing dialogue around them. We're part of a political process in which we're sort of strategically sending out those reports. That isn't what's going on in Iraq right now at all. And that accountability and the transparency also in terms of what we're writing is just not there. And those are exactly the sorts of relationships, the relationships that allow for that transparency and accountability to to occur, both in terms of independent reporting and in terms of other potential forms of solidarity work, are exactly, those are exactly the relationships we need to build. And the question of how to build those relationships in a place like Iraq, under a brutal occupation, after a brutal dictatorship, are sort of the questions that then have to underlie all the rest of the questions I'm going to talk about now. Ultimately, I think these relationships are important to build, no matter how complicated it is, because because I think it's imperative that that we do claim solidarity with Iraqi people struggling under occupation, and that we do that from our place here in North America, in the belly of the beast, in the middle of the empire. And if we do that, we do it because in some ways, we, in some genuine way, we believe that our struggles really do overlap, that our struggle for freedom and justice really do, as the cliche goes, really is bound up in Iraqis' struggles for freedom and justice. And I think that as anti-authoritarians, we're compelled to engage in that solidarity work because we hold certain values as good things. And I'm going to highlight three of them quickly and talk then about what I think they mean about the quality and the stance we have to take in our work. The first is just that we privilege and struggle for and believe in the goodness of freedom from all forms of domination, whether that's economic domination, military domination, racialized gender domination, and all of these as they are encompassed in forms of colonial and neocolonial occupation and domination. The second is that we hold mutual aid to be a good, and the third is that we privilege autonomy and the self-determination, the right to self-determination that implies, while recognizing that self-determination is an incredibly complex term that we often oversimplify, because self-determination is something we believe in as anti-authoritarians, both for communities, political groupings, but also for individuals, and that there's often a great deal of tension between those things, those two. These three values, I think, then, yeah, do suggest specific way and specific quality of our solidarity, and that our solidarity must take if it's going to be genuine. If we believe in freedom from domination, that is good, then it means that we have to be constantly critical of all the dynamics of domination, not only within our own movements, but within other movements that we ally with. If we hold mutual aid to be a good, then we have to enter our solidarity work believing that and trying to instantiate the fact that it isn't charity work, that we're not going to help other people in order to be good people, but because our struggles are intrinsically linked. And that it also means to me, and started to mean very much in Iraq, that there's a very real sense in which each one of us has to be ready to risk just as much in that solidarity work and in our work for justice as the people we know who are forced to live under occupation in places like Iraq and in Palestine. And then what exactly that means, what taking that risk means, particularly when you're talking about building a movement here and an anti-imperialist, anti-authoritarian movement here, is a little bit of a head wreck to me. And then the concept of autonomy and of self-determination means always that we have to cherish the fact that people on the front lines in Iraq, in Palestine, in other occupied places, we are in solidarity with, lead their struggle, they determine their own strategies, and that our support for them needs not to be uncritical, but it needs to be transparent in that criticism. And that we need to build the relationships that allow for that accountability and for that transparency. So if everything, you know, there's like a tendency in Montreal to say that I'm a hypocritical of everything. So if everything that internationals are doing in Iraq is horrible, which so far more or less has been, what are other models of solidarity? I'm not sure that these are all completely other models of solidarity, but I'm going to lay out sort of four different models that then I think we can talk about, and I'm going to open for questions after that. How we weigh those different models, relying on some of the values that I've talked about or on other criteria. I guess the first model I've thought about and that I've polled people on is a sort of non-engagement model as anti-authoritarian, since so many of the movements and of the resistances that we in theory would like to support are so problematic to us. And this, of course, leads to a form of quietism, but before, which is completely untenable to me. But just to play out a little bit, sort of what this sort of non-engagement model of things looks like, we have to sort of reckon, I think, as anti-authoritarians, with the fact that anarchists have never been particularly renowned for their support of anti-imperialist or anti-colonial struggles, and that this is a problem. It's a problem we need to grapple with really urgently, particularly given our location. And one of the obvious reasons for that is that liberation struggles are often bound up in national liberation struggles, struggles for national self-determination that have at least as one of their ultimate ends a sovereign state, free from colonial or neo-colonial domination. And certainly this is the case in Iraq, although the form that that state will ultimately take is highly contested by Iraqis. And, you know, as anti-authoritarians, we've often been wary of getting involved in supporting national liberation struggles for fear of supporting the formation of nation states, which basically reify exclusionary practices and practices of domination. This is a dilemma. I think it's one we need to get past in various ways. It's certainly very obvious to me that in Iraq, the call for a sovereign state and national elections, when it was made by Sistani in response to the U.S.'s announcement that it was going to transfer sovereignty, was a very powerful political tool for an opposition to the occupation. And so one of the things I wonder then is if, in supporting liberation struggles, where we tend to worry about supporting an emerging elite or a new regime in a place like Iraq, or a comprador class, to use Fanon's term, that will, again, use the construct of the nation state to exclude and to dominate other groups. Maybe trying to work in a solidarist way, in a way that doesn't reinforce the emergence, not of a state, but of a particular form of domination by an elite, in a given place. Maybe that is one of the ways around it, or maybe one of the compromises to be made. In any case, whatever ultimately our answer to that ambivalence is, I think a quietism around that, a sort of wait-and-see attitude, or an attitude that says we will not engage in solidarity with these movements in any way at all, because ultimately they want a nation state, is basically untenable. And that because of how brutal the domination is, and because of our particular role of complicity in the system that perpetuates it in places like Iraq. The second, I guess, model would be to respond only when there are indigenous movements, or perhaps political parties, unclear to me, that call for assistance in a very sort of prescribed and circumscribed way. And here you can think of the ways in which the Zapatistas had a very clear program to offer international organizations and groups and individuals who said that they wanted to do solidarity work with them. There's a few questions I have about this model. The first is that I think that there's a tendency to interpret this sort of principle as the idea that we should wait until a perfect resistance movement in a place arises, something that is not only useful to the people there, but something that in some ways, like the Zapatistas, reflects our own aspirations for freedom, for a deeper democracy, etc. And that seems to me to be almost equally quietistic and problematic, given our place of privilege in a system that we can largely talk about as a system of global apartheid, where many of us, most of us, really benefit from that system. It also is sort of a model that I think is based on an unspoken principle that we should support movements that are most like us and that we can relate to most easily. And ironically, in Iraq, that has led for the anti-war movement in many places in North America and in Europe to sort of uncritically support in various ways a Baathist anti-imperialist line, because it's very much secularist and it's very much sort of comfortable to leftists, whereas it's much harder for us to imagine supporting the political Islam and the movements that have arisen there that are Islamist. Now, I'm not arguing that we should, you know, be supporting one or the other, but I do think it's problematic to expect to do international solidarity work and wait for people who are just like us. The third model, I guess, would be a sort of uncritical support for any and all resistance in a place like Iraq. But that obviously poses huge problems and doesn't resolve any of the dilemmas in terms of how you balance an anti-authoritarian viewpoint and commitment with also doing that solidarity work. And then the fourth model I've talked with people about is again a non-engagement, but this time it's a non-engagement that acts here and places the struggle here, and this was talked about at the last panel. So I'm just going to frame it in the way I started thinking about it. You know, this would be a sort of solidarity work that would effectively bring resistance home. In Iraq, everything is covered in, not everything, all the important buildings, meaning, you know, the hotel complexes where foreign journalists stay, the government buildings, the UN building before it got blown up, the major humanitarian NGO buildings, they're all surrounded by blast walls, huge concrete barriers that are supposed to prevent car bombings from taking a toll on the people working inside. And those blast walls, to me, always irk me. And they were such a brutal demonstration of whose life internationally we valued in Iraq. So it was all the international staffs were protected by them, the NGOs, people who, you know, this wasn't just sort of the government, wasn't just the coalition authorities. It was people who purported to be there in solidarity with or to help whatever the Iraqi people. And those barriers were just such obvious delimitations of who was important, whose life was worth more than others, and it really mimicked, the ways in which our borders, the borders in North America, the borders in Europe, delimit whose lives are worthwhile and whose lives can be lost, infinitely almost, it seems. And watching the news these days in Iraq, it seems like those lives can be lost infinitely, so long as that process allows those of us who live behind the blast walls to enjoy a higher standard of life, to continue in a system of relative privilege derived from an economy and protected by military. And so my question there was always, if these people have to risk so much just to wake up in the morning and get to school, or just to find a job, often in complicity with an occupier who they don't want to be there, and then risk being blown up as an interpreter or as an Iraqi policeman. What are the ways in which we can move this struggle in a really tangible way inside the blast walls that surround our nation states and are increasingly locking us down? And so that's the question I leave us with, and I think I'll stop there. Without saying much more.